Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. I'm joined today, I'm delighted to say, by Mick Ryan, a retired Australian Army Major General, very experienced in the field of warfare. Also, will be known to many of you from his books, War Transformed, The Future of 21st Century Great Power Competition and Conflict, and his new book, which is a fictionalized account of a future war involving the US and China and Taiwan. Welcome to the Reaction Podcast.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
So you've just been in Ukraine very recently on this trip to Europe. What's your assessment of where we are in terms of the conflict and the progress that's being made by the Ukrainians on the ground?
Well, I think we're in a better position than what Ukraine was in this time last year in many respects. The effects on the ground in the south probably have not been as profound as some had hoped or expected, but they have slowly, surely chewed their way into the Russian defensive lines. But I think more importantly than territory liberated is they've really inflicted a massive amount of destruction on the Russian armed forces. I mean, they have not been capable of offensive operations to any great degree. Their northeastern offensive has largely been a damp squib around Bakhmut. The Ukrainians are on the offensive there and are advancing, and the Russians are actually in trouble there. And in the south, I mean, there's been a small bit of territory regained, but I think the Ukrainians have learned a lot of lessons about what modern war actually is. I think some of the collective training they received before the offensive was probably based on 1990s doctrine and technologies, and in some ways reflects an intellectual failure on our behalf to kind of realise that our 90s combined arms doctrine and technologies for breaching needed to be updated as a result of not just the Russian defensive positions, but what we learned over the last 18 months about a more transparent battlefield, about better connected sensors to fires, and these kind of technologies that have really, I think, changed the pace and lethality of the modern battlefield. It's not the battlefield that a lot of our doctrine was written for. Mm-hmm. It's not the battlefield that our combined arms doctrine has prepared us well for.
So for non-specialists, me included, explain to us what that 1990s doctrine looked like.
Well, 1990s doctrine looked like an environment where you had a preponderance of air power. You didn't have to look up for threats, you just had to look forward for threats. I think that was an important component. It was reliant on an enemy that was largely symmetrical, that also fought with tanks and artillery, reconnaissance, engineers, logistics, these kind of things. But it was also an environment where sensors were not pervasive, where individual soldiers did not have their own recon drones, where digital command and control was not a thing yet, where the connectivity offered by digital command and control had not really exerted its power like it has now. So I think there's been a lot of changes over the last 30 years that our operations in places like Iraq and Afghanistan have resulted in us becoming intellectually lazy about high-intensity, large-scale, long-duration, highly lethal warfare that we're now seeing now. We haven't seen this for 30 years, not since the 1991 Gulf War, and we've forgotten it. And I think, some of the preparation that was given to the Ukrainians did not really prepare them well enough for that environment.
And in War Transformed, well, of course, War Transformed is published before Ukraine invasion or just as it's about to happen.
That's right.
But a major theme of that is continuity. And of course, technology matters, and you write very lucidly about what technology brings. But explain to us what you mean by that continuity in warfare.
Well, a lot of books you see now about warfare are all about the stunning changes in technology. The reality is war actually has far more continuities. It has things that don't change. So things like the importance of leadership, which we've rediscovered, but is not a new lesson. from Ukraine, things like logistics and supporting soldiers. Not a new lesson, but we've rediscovered the importance of logistics in Ukraine. But I think the most important continuity is that military operations are a continuity of politics. Clausewitz wrote about this. That has not changed. And at the end of the day, I think the Ukrainians have demonstrated a better ability to align their military affairs with the political outcomes than the Russians have. I mean, the Russians had a political objective of subjugating all of Ukraine, but they never had the military means to achieve that. So they haven't done that as well. So I think these continuities are important. And at the end of the day, every war is an aggregation of ideas that have gone before it with a couple of new things. And I think that's really what we've seen in Ukraine. Lots and lots of old ideas mashed up with a couple of new ones, be they drones, whether it's digitized command and control, whether it's a meshing of civil and military sensors on the battlefield and in the strategic arena.
I mean, one of the things that struck me reading War Transformed more than a year ago was this question of whether there are applications in other fields of human endeavour. And it's a theme that's interested me a lot in terms of finance. And you know, I've written about the written appeals for the human scale and for considering the human dimension. We're moving faster and faster into this kind of AI digitized world in which the numbers and the data mean everything, or we're told that they can tell us everything, and actually they can't, that there are ephemeral, subjective human forces at work that we shouldn't lose sight of.
Yeah, I think technology always works best when it's controlled by clever human beings. I mean, there is no silver bullet in warfare. I mean, we've seen in the last 100 years or so this constant search for technological silver bullets. I mean, the Nazis with their wonder weapons, whether it was the vengeance weapons or a range of other initiatives, really tried to find that one thing that would result in a significant change in their fortunes. They never quite got there, but no one else has either. The reality is that good technologies always require clever concepts of employment, good tactics, and new organisational constructs to exploit them to maximum effect, whether it's aircraft requiring air forces, whether it's aircraft carriers requiring totally different tactics and different promotion pathways. And it'll be the same with artificial intelligence. It will require the application of smart concepts and partnering with humans, not replacing humans, to realise its full potential, not just on the battlefield, but in a whole range of strategic endeavours beyond the military.
And while continuity matters, there is also, as you've written, enormous technological change going on. Which of those new technologies interests you most? What should commentators look out for in the years and decades ahead?
Well, I think a very interesting approach, it's not a single technology, but is the meshing of civil and military sensors on the battlefield and in the strategic arena, and then not just the meshing of collection, but the meshing of analysis. I mean, intelligence analysis is no longer the sole domain of military or government organisations. You have a whole range of civil analytical capabilities, whether they're Bellingcat or a whole range of similar organisations.
So private companies, foundations.
That's right. And what you're seeing is there's a meshing between them and the military. They're overlapping each other and being combined during this war in a way that we haven't seen before. And it's being used by the Ukrainians, lesser extent by the Russians, but they're using it. But also, you know, a range of observers who are looking at this war in the military and intelligence agencies, and people like myself who use, you know, a whole range of social media and unofficial means to watch what is going on and make assessments. So I think that's an important technological development that is transforming how we view war and how people are able to plan and execute military operations. A second really important technology is this array of digitized battle command and support systems. For the Ukrainians, the Delta system has democratized access to information on the battlefield. Essentially, if you have a smart device, you can download this, you can input information and download information, so it has a two-way feed. And we haven't seen that level of democratization for battlefield command and control systems before. Generally, these are secret systems. Not everyone has access to them. Key commanders do. down to certain levels, but it's not something that every single person has access to pull information out of or input information to. And it's important not only because it is speeding up the ability to have a common picture of what is going on, it is speeding up transmission of collaboration and transmission of orders, but most profoundly what it's doing is closing the gap between the detection and destruction of military forces. If you link this meshed sensor system with digitized command and control, it enables the ability to build a more transparent picture and then decide which elements of those picture will be engaged and destroyed. And that's really what we've seen throughout this war, that both sides have leveraged a more transparent battle space to target their artillery, target loitering drones, target a whole range of systems that make survivability much more difficult, driving greater dispersion, more deception, more camouflage, these kind of things. Now, the third technology I think is important is autonomous systems. I mean, primarily in the air at the moment, and in many respects, the last 18 months has been a Cambrian explosion. It is probably the most intense period of innovation in autonomous systems in history. We saw pulses of innovation in the Iraq War in particular for ground and base systems. We saw some of it in the Second World War, some of it in Vietnam, but nothing like what we've seen now, certainly not at the scale, certainly not with the array of different mission sets right down to individual soldiers. So I think it's an important technology. In some respects, we're really just seeing the tip of the iceberg because we're not there yet when it comes to ground systems, only just starting. And even maritime systems, we're seeing the birth of these uncrewed systems that the Ukrainians are using to deny large parts of the Black Sea to the Russian Black Sea fleet. So I think autonomous systems are an important technology, but there's a long way to go in their development. And there's a long way to go in the tactics and in the training and in the leadership models required as we see more and more of these systems go into military units.
But you mentioned the both sides. So it's not just the Ukrainians who have innovated, you suggest. There has been Russian innovation after they started the war very badly.
Absolutely. I mean, both General Zaluzhny, the Ukrainian commander-in-chief, and General Sierski, who is the commander of their ground forces and is commanding their operational theatre in the east at the moment, have both said the Russians are not idiots. There's two reasons they say that. One, out of prudence, you don't assume your enemy is an idiot, you don't want to underestimate them. But two, the Russians have adapted throughout this war, whether it is to learn from the really bad outcomes for them in the north of Ukraine. They adapted the kind of operations they were going to undertake in the east. They've adapted their objectives. They've adapted their tactics, whether it was with Wagner Group or the Stormzy units, or shifting to more defensive operations, going back to more traditional obstacles and mines. So they have adapted. They've also used the array of digital command and control, electronic warfare, autonomous systems, which continues to make life very difficult for the Ukrainian military.
And why do you think they took the approach that they initially did? Was it that the leadership was arrogant? And the Russia's president was arrogant about how simple this would be. Is it as simple as that, or is it also to do with how the Ukrainians themselves fought back so bravely and innovated at speed?
Well, I mean, there's never a single reason for these things, unfortunately. I mean, from the Russian perspective, they'd been conducting operations in places like Georgia, Syria, Ukraine, Chechnya over the last 20 years. And, you know, from that, they drew certain conclusions about how their enemy would react, how the West would react in particular. So they made a whole lot of assumptions. Their intelligence services gave a whole lot of undertakings to President Putin that they weren't really in a good position to make about the longevity and status of the Ukrainian government, about the unity of the Ukrainian people, and about the capability to fight of the Ukrainian military. In many respects, they assumed that the Ukraine they were going to overwhelm, was their assumption in 2022, was very similar to that that existed in 2014. And it just wasn't. The Ukrainians had had a major shock by 2014, both Crimea and the operations in the Donbass. Over that eight-year period, they'd gone through constant reform, updating their doctrines to better align with NATO. NATO had done training missions inside Ukraine. Ukraine had sent officers overseas to learn Western planning and leadership models. And they had 8 years of battlefield experience. I mean, every senior Ukrainian leader today, from General Zaluzhny on down, commanded at battalion and brigade level in the Donbass. And that is a really profound learning experience and a corporate knowledge that is very, very difficult to get otherwise. So, you know, the Russians made some major assumptions about a three-day run to Kyiv, where the government would fall and they would basically turn Ukraine into something like Belarus is at the moment. The Ukrainians proved them wrong. And I think in some respects, they even shocked themselves by the national unity and resolve that was shown. But pretty quickly, within 24 hours, it was a nation that was a nation in arms, that had embraced people's war, where civilians were helping soldiers defend north of Kyiv and in other places. It shocked the Russians, and they have never really fully recovered strategically since then.
Proved them wrong, thank goodness. But what are the prospects now, do you think? What for the next phase of the war, and what's the end game?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last 18 months is both sides of, mainly the Russians, but also to the Ukrainians to a certain extent, have lost their pre-war professional militaries. Casualties are such that they've had to rebuild their military institutions on the run over the last 18 months. I mean, Russia's done its partial mobilization as well as, you know, inducting 20 to 30,000 new soldiers per month since then as well. And the Ukrainians have, you know, expanded from 200,000 to 1 million service personnel over that period. So what we're seeing is they're fighting whilst they're rebuilding their military to suit the current circumstances, not the circumstances they anticipated before this war. That takes time. And we've seen in previous war, like World War I, World War II, where there's an interregnum between the initial big battles, when they learn and adapt and when they are able to succeed in the situation as it is. So I think we're in that position at the moment. I think the Ukrainians at the moment hold the strategic initiative. They probably will going into winter. I expect that they will continue their operations on the ground, particularly in the south, as much as they can. And I expect that they'll expand their strategic strike campaign in Russia and Crimea. In particular, they will destroy Russian power facilities if the Ukrainians try that with them. They've already signaled that that's what they're going to do. So, you know, you've got a more capable Ukrainian military now than what we saw last year across a full range of strategic and tactical capabilities. And I think as long as the West holds its nerve and the Americans are able to approve some kind of subsequent support package for the Ukrainians, they'll be in good shape for 2024.
Well, that brings me on very neatly to the next question I was going to ask you, which is about that geopolitical backdrop and the politics. There's a lot of concern, isn't there? There's an American election next year, potential for a lot of change, potentially a return of President Trump, whose attitude to Ukraine is, let's put it politely, is ambiguous, difficult to read precisely how American policy would change. Do you think we're right to be worried in Europe about this, or will the alliance hold?
No, I think we're right to be worried. I think that's prudent. I think that you see an organization now that's preparing itself to be an administration or a Trump administration. I mean, I think The Economist has done some really interesting work looking at those preparing it, and it will be a much better prepared and much more competent administration than what we saw last time. And that should worry people. I mean, Trump's penchant for focusing on authoritarians, you know, he admires Putin. He thought Xi was a pretty good guy. He liked talking to the leader of North Korea whilst really denigrating long-standing alliance relationships in Europe and in other places. I mean, Australia was lucky we kind of escaped that, but that's no certainty that we wouldn't in the future, particularly given the massive transfer of technology that might be required under an AUKUS submarine project. So, you know, I think we're prudent to be concerned about a future Trump administration. But just the state of the American polity at the moment, where they seem to be paralysed, where consensus is something to be avoided, not sought, like most modern, mature democracies. There seems to be this schism between the two sides of Congress that is very difficult to bridge at the moment. And we'll see that with, you know, this coming election of the current Speaker, McCarthy. You know, what happens there? Who will side with him and who won't? Will there be Democrats? Will there be Republicans? So, you know, the American polity is, I won't say it's on life support, but, you know, it's not well at the moment. And when a lot of the world looks to them to be a shining example, they're not providing that shining example that we all seek and that we all need at the moment.
But what does the alliance look like if the worst comes to the worst? Because you have Europe, which is rearming, or parts of Europe which are rearming, the stuff that the Poles are doing, very aggressively increasing military spending up to at least 4% of GDP this year, and maybe even more. The work that Sweden and Finland are doing, even putting NATO to one side, but the extra spending that's going on, the work of the Baltic states, who've been warning about Russian ambitions for a long time and people didn't listen. So you have all of that going on, and NATO coming up with a new deterrence plan or war plan, however you want to phrase it, but a new way of thinking about European security. And then Australia and Japan both adopting a new security stance that's very interesting, and strengthening links in Europe and in the US. What happens then if the US president, well, let's put to one side, Congress might actually just say we don't really believe in the president's military policy, and of course that congressional Pentagon relationship is almost as important as the relationship between the White House and the Pentagon. It's a recipe for potential chaos.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of hedging at the moment. Countries in Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, they know the danger that Russia poses. I mean, Poland knows. They're making really, really significant investments. You know, and they have to make prudent investments for a couple of reasons. You know, what happens if the US and NATO aren't as effective in the future?
There's an element of an insurance policy.
That they have to. They have no choice. You know, and what if the worst happens at the Ukraine, that Ukraine loses? Well, Poland becomes the frontline state. They know what the Russians are like. I mean, the Second World War, Poland wasn't just invaded by Germany, right? It was also invaded by Russia. They know what Russia's like, and they don't want that to happen again. So they're making themselves the hardest possible target that they can. Your Finland and Sweden Sweden's reintroduced national service. Their joining NATO was stunning. It's something they didn't do throughout the whole Cold War, and they've done it. So you're seeing countries like this. The Baltics have given away just about all their military equipment to Ukraine because they know Ukraine has to win. A world where Russia beats Ukraine is a very dark world indeed, not just for those who are on the front line against Russia, but for all of us. It would normalise the kind of brutal, repressive, predatory behaviours that we had hoped we'd seen off at the end of the Second World War. In our region, you've seen countries from the Philippines to Japan to Taiwan really re-energising thinking about conflict, thinking about deterring China, looking at recapitalising key capabilities, particularly long-range strike. You see the engagement with just about every country in the region wanting the Americans there, even the Vietnamese. So you're seeing this hub and spoke of relationships, whether they're alliances or security partnerships. It's not an Asian NATO. There will never be an Asian NATO. It just isn't how the region works, but there is a network of alliances and relationships there that is very important. The Japanese white paper that came out about a month ago, I commend it to you, readers, a very good document for several reasons. Firstly, to explain to its citizens and other citizens the threat. It does a very good job of that, certainly better than the Australian Strategic Review did that was released in April. But it also does a very good job of justifying why Japan needs to double its GDP spent on defence, which is a stunning kind of outcome in and of itself. I mean, ever since 1945, it's been locked at 1%. Now, that's a pretty big 1% because it's a significantly sized economy, but to double that is a really profound statement from the Japanese of their concern about regional security. I mean, Australia's made some big announcements. It hasn't really been followed through financially. There has been no increase in defence spending, and indeed it's gone down because of inflation. And we're seeing the first of significant cuts to the services to pay for these nuclear submarines that we may or may not see at some point in the coming decades. So, I mean, the Japanese really are leading the way in Asia when it comes to responding to the Chinese threat, and it is a very profound, in many respects, existential threat that many countries face. And they're backing that up with money.
Mm. And I assume, or are we right to assume, that even if Trump withdraws from Europe in some way or reduces the commitment to Europe and political chaos ensues in Europe as a result, even in those circumstances, that the American commitment in your region in the Pacific, that wouldn't change at all, but because America sees China as the and there is a bipartisan consensus, mm-hmm. which views China as the threat.
Is at the moment. There's certainly a bipartisan consensus about the threat America poses to the United States, both militarily and economically. I think more economically than and militarily from some folks. So the assumption is that the Americans would, you know, leave Europe and focus on Asia. I just don't know whether it's that easy for the Americans to disentangle themselves from Europe for a couple of reasons. One, it has, since the end of the Second World War, undertaken a whole range of diplomatic, economic and military relationships to ensure there isn't war in Europe again, because it's in its direct interest for there not to be war there. But secondly, what happens in Europe has an impact in other parts of the world as well. It's not like what happens in Europe stays in Europe. That's just not the case. What happens in Europe and what Russia is able to get away with in Europe, you know, emboldens China and vice versa. So, you know, as much as the Trumpists would like to disengage from Europe or not support NATO, I think they'll find the reality very different and much more difficult to extract themselves from. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah. Also, during his first term, his rhetoric, which was very anti-NATO, sceptical of NATO and critical of European allies, was at odds with what the administration actually did, because deployments increased and spending on European, I think it's called the European Defence Deterrence Initiative, all of that increased, and there was more money spent than was spent by Obama on European defence. So it's possible that there was a rhetorical game being there, or I suppose we just don't know with Trump, do we? That is what he regards as his political superpower, is unpredictability.
Yeah, and I mean, he appeals to a certain part of the electorate, and, you know, reality doesn't have anything to do with it. It's more about what he says and tweets rather than what he does. But, you know, I also think in his administration there were a group of people who genuinely wanted to look after the United States' national security interests and were able to work their magic to ensure Trump's worst instincts weren't realised. I'm not sure that group of people will exist if he comes back.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about your career. How did you... You're retired now, but you had a long career doing a lot of very interesting things, which gives you this expertise. But then you have retired and become a writer, expert. Your podcast has a very big following, on Twitter, and you write very, very clearly and cogently about these themes. Is this something you always wanted to do once you retired?
I like writing. It's kind of like my yoga. You know, I've been writing articles for about 24, 25 years. For me, it's how you have your say and influence debate. You know, it wasn't really until the last few years I started thinking about what I wanted to do when I left the military, because, I mean, everyone has to leave eventually, and it's better to leave with a plan than without a plan. And the big decision you make, I think, especially as a senior officer, is when you leave, do you want to still be owned or do you want to do your own thing? And I decided I wanted to do my own thing. So, you know, I have a portfolio. I do a bit of strategic advising. I do a bit of writing, do a bit of speaking. You know, I do a bit of work with the fellowships at CSIS and Lowy Institute in Australia. And I find that really rewarding. It allows me to do a bit of research and writing and do a bit of travel and you know, work and speak with a bunch of fascinating people in the national security field, particularly when it comes to military strategy.
And what were the main experiences in your career that shaped your worldview?
Lots and lots. It wasn't just experiences, it was people. I think the thing that really shaped a lot of how I think is my very first year in the military at the academy, where I failed. You know, I failed I was doing civil engineering. I failed all eight subjects. I think that's still a record there. But, you know, I was given a second chance. So it taught me a couple of really important lessons. One, it's actually okay to fail. You can pick yourself up. And I think young kids these days, that's a really important message, because for a lot of them, one failure is traumatic. But secondly, it taught me that I was in an institution that believed in second chances, and that's shaped my outlook ever since then. But no, I've been very fortunate. I was in an army that, you know, gave me a huge array of different opportunities to command, to study overseas, to deploy on operations, to work for some really superb leaders. I mean, I worked for a couple of leaders that weren't superb, as we do in the military, and, you know, stay around as long as I did, you find them. But I think, you know, my time at Quantico, which was over the 9/11 period, really reinvigorated my love of the profession and to want to be an expert in the intellectual dimensions as well as all the other pragmatic aspects of it. You know, my deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan had a really significant impact on me. And then, you know, I was fortunate to go and work for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the Pentagon as a strategist, and that really shaped not just the military side of things, but the interaction with Congress, with the media, a whole range of other agencies. So, you know, it's not just been one thing, but it's been a bunch of events, experiences and people that I've been deeply fortunate to be associated with over, you know, 3.5 decades.
And so 9/11, I was going to say, had a big impact you in terms of where it took you in the world. So what was that deployment there you mentioned to the US Joint Chiefs of Staff? What was that like?
No, it was pretty amazing. So, you know, 9/11, I was a young major. I was a student at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College. And, you know, I did subsequent deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. But 09, I got asked to go and be on the staff for the chairman, his Pakistan-Afghanistan coordination cell. I mean, it was fascinating. I mean, it was difficult. I was the first foreigner ever allowed in their National Military Command Center. There's a whole range of security things there. It took months to really sort through. It's kind of a very humbling experience to be escorted to the bathroom every day, but, you know, I don't hold that against anyone. It was just the system that was in place that wasn't used to having a foreigner down there, and we worked our way through it. And I felt like my contribution was valued. I got to work for some just extraordinary leaders, I thought, not directly but indirectly as well, who I remain in contact with and who I continue to admire deeply for their ongoing contributions to not just American but other national security endeavours.
And America does have that tradition. Think of someone like Mattis, of the intellectual general with a very sophisticated worldview. you could argue sometimes that then collides with the sort of realities of politics and what politicians ask them to do, but it is a very sophisticated trade.
No, it is. I think, you know, William St. Murray had a great quote about it being the most intellectually and morally demanding profession. And, you know, our people deserve better than slovenly thinking. And it's a great quote. I look at people like General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, and a range of others like John Allen, Mick Nicholson, David Petraeus, all of whom I work for at one point or another, is this kind of elite group of thinking, pragmatic, experienced military leaders that are rare, frankly. Not many militaries are able to produce them, and none in that kind of quantity. And, you know, the Americans do value the intellectual pursuits. You know, having a PhD as a US Army officer is not a career killer like it is in a lot of other military institutions. But it's not something they bang a drum about. They just crack on and they get on with life. So, you know, they are unique in that respect. It's not to say the American military is perfect, even they'll tell you they have flaws. We all do. Every military institution does. But, you know, the thing I like about the Americans and military institutions like my own, the British and a few others, is that they have values that I think are perfect, but we never quite meet them. We always fall short, but at least we're always aiming for those values in how we act, how we perform on the battlefield, how we try to treat our people, how we try to treat our veterans. And, you know, that it makes me really proud to have been part of the profession of arms, because I think it's a very noble undertaking.
The next testing ground for the American military may end up being China. How do you see the situation? We'll talk about your book on Taiwan in a moment. But what's your assessment about how close potential conflict is?
Well, I think you can come up with a range of different scenarios, and clearly I came up with one in my book, but there's an array of potential futures here. Everything from we just keep going on how we're going now and there is no war, as undesirable as that might be for some people, it's certainly better than any kind of catastrophic war that we might find ourselves in, through to blockades, through to an array of different kind of conflicts, you know, that we might find ourselves in. You know, and I think when people look at this, I'd encourage them to look at the early days of the Ukraine-Russia war. These are two countries that have lived next to each other for a very long time. Ukraine was part of the USSR, so they knew each other very well. And still, they surprised each other. The Chinese and the Americans have not fought each other since Korea. They did fight each other there, but, you know, it's been 70 years plus since Americans and Chinese have looked at each other and shot at each other and known each other as deadly enemies. There will be a lot of areas where each side does not understand the other. Doesn't matter how good our intelligence is. It doesn't matter how well prepared we are. The initial stages of any conflict, if it happens, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does, there'll be a lot of learning about each other. And those who are able to learn and adapt best and quickest at all the different levels are those who are going to be able to generate an advantage. So we need to be very careful about being arrogant about potential outcomes here. I do see this in the Chinese probably more than the Americans. I think the Americans are more circumspect than the Chinese are. You see a lot of pretty vicious propaganda out of the Chinese about this. And the Chinese need to be careful. They need to be careful not to whip up national sentiment too much that some kind of conflict becomes unavoidable. I think there's a lot of unknowns. You know, we think ourselves pretty clever. We think that a war between China and the United States is unthinkable because of economic interactions, but we've thought that before. And I would encourage people to read Norman Engel's book that was written before World War One, where people thought exactly the same thing. And you know, the lead up to World War One, in some respects, reflects the current environment where we're not just two large or large powers looking at each other warily, but also the pace of technological change. Philip Blom's book, The Vertigo Years, covers this beautifully. So, you know, I think there's a lot from history that might provide us some insights into how the current strategic competition is. But there is no doubt a conflict in the Western Pacific between China and the United States over Taiwan or any other issue would be catastrophic for China and the region and would dump the world into a recession or worse for some time.
Yeah, but it has been a consistent theme in the last century and more, this idea that if you improve trade and increase economic links, then that automatically means that war is less likely, which time and again has turned out to be wrong. Germany and the UK were incredibly close culturally and economically in the years running up to the First World War, but war still happened.
Yeah, I guess look at France and Germany in the 1800s. You know, look at the north and south of the United States. So it's a theory that hasn't been proved yet, but people keep rolling it out for some reason. It's amazing how much great information we hide away in books. I just wish more people would read them. And, you know, we had the great theory in the early 90s that if China went into the World Trade Organization, that if we supported its economic development, that would lead to political liberalization. Well, we've accepted now that that was a bad theory and it hasn't worked out that way. They've certainly developed economically, but politically they've gone in a very, very different direction than Clinton and others hoped for back in the 90s. I'm not saying they were the wrong hopes, so they're the exact right hopes, but they've been proven to not have worked out, unfortunately.
And there was a bit of confirmation bias in the West as well. We wanted it to be true. And then when a different kind of leader turns up, Xi, who we're trying to assume that, well, he can't really mean all this stuff in his Marxist writing, but it turns out that's the real thing. And the arc shift bends away from liberalization and back towards authoritarianism or even totalitarianism because of the impact of personality, again, as we were discussing at the beginning of our chat.
Now, kind of turns out that authoritarians like telling us what they're going to do.
Yes.
I mean, if you have a look at Putin's writings and speeches in the lead up to Ukraine, he was telling us exactly, we just weren't listening, and Xi's been telling us for a long time. So we probably just need to listen to them and go, well, maybe we should be ready just in case the worst does happen.
Yes. What would China do with Australia, do you think? What would its attitude to Australia be during a conflict if it happens? And as you say, let's hope it can be averted. And how would Australia respond?
Well, you know, I think like any politician, Australian politicians would like to keep their options open. I don't think they have too many, to be quite frank. If China decided that the sovereignty of a island democracy of 25 million people in the Western Pacific was something it wanted to squash, it would be very difficult for Australia to have a neutral opinion on that. It can't do what the Global South is doing at the moment for Ukraine. Either you defend democracies or, you know, what do you do if you don't defend democracies? You're not defending yourself as well. So I think Australia would be drawn into some kind of conflict. What that might look like, I'm not sure. Certainly our real estate is very valuable to the Americans for a whole range of reasons. But I think it would be inevitable that there'd be like a centrifugal kind of pull for Australia and a whole range of other countries to be involved, including Europe. I think it would be difficult for Europe to avoid some kind of conflict. But because, you know, once again, if China wins, you result in a global security environment that's much darker, much more predatory, and the kind of environment that all of us have believed in and fought for since the end of the Second World War.
And on defence and security, links between Australia and the US are being strengthened.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine them being stronger. I mean, we've had a close security relationship with the Americans since 1942. I mean, about 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, there was a discussion about, you know, which way does Australia fall, its major economic partner or major security partner. Well, that was a silly conversation. It never made sense. Australia made its choice in 1942 and it has not changed its direction since. China was never going to be a security partner for Australia. It just doesn't have any of our values. It shares none of our systems. It shares none of our aspirations or history. So that was just a stupid, uninformed conversation. So we have a close relationship with the United States. It's not just security, it's economic, it's values-based. There's a lot of similarities between our societies, but there are some profound differences as well.
So let's talk a bit about White Sun War, your new book. You fictionalize a devastating war between the US and China over Taiwan, and it's set in 2028, I think. Now, why write this as fiction rather than non-fiction and analysis?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me that. There's a few reasons. Humans have always passed on information through stories. You know, since the cavemen and women were sitting around a campfire at night, they told stories. That's how they taught people. That's how they passed on histories. That's how they got things done together. So we're used to hearing stories. I also find that when it comes to military affairs, sometimes stories can be more palatable than the actual facts of what military operations are like. So you kind of blend up a whole lot of facts into the chocolate milkshake that is a story and hope people will read it, enjoy it, but also learn something from it. So, you know, they're the reasons why I thought a fictionalized approach might work in this. And if you want to inform more people, fiction is a great way to do it.
Of course, one of the key themes in the novel is this, we talked about it a bit earlier, the use of advanced technologies, unmanned fighting systems, armoured vehicles. I mean, the fact that you've set it in 2028, that suggests you think that kind of war is here now or is very, very close.
Yeah, I think we're already seeing it in Ukraine in many respects. And I think over the coming years, the density of autonomous systems is only going to deepen in military organisation. It doesn't matter what service we're talking about here, Army, Navy, Air Force, Space Force. So, this is something that's here to stay. It's going to become more and more attractive to large and small countries. We're going to see developments in things like power management, in the level of autonomy these things have, the ability to work together, but also how we team large numbers of autonomous systems with humans. I mean, that's still in its infancy, and our training systems and our military concepts are still very much designed for human-centric organisations.
Mick Ryan, great to see you back in Europe, and thank you very much for your time. That was Mick Ryan I've been talking to, and his latest book, White Sun War, comes highly recommended. And if you haven't read War Transformed, I urge you to. It's a must read book. You've been listening to The Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin. If you're not a subscriber to The Reaction website, where you get my weekly newsletter on politics and geopolitics and culture and economics, then you go to the website, sign up, www.reaction.life. Until next time, thank you for listening.